check the audio archive at kpfk.org.
You know what this is?
KPFK is support.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right. Decisions, decisions, decisions. All kinds of decisions that are getting made and need to be made. And ones that need to be overturned as well. And this show is going to, that's kind of be a kind of a, like a little bit of a theme today, but we'll wait and see. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Andy Z, co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and member of the National Revolution Tour. And we're going to be talking on the situation we're in today and mass meetings to make plans to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. That's right, drive them out. Before that, we'll be talking with Atlas Winfrey, who's from Refuse Fascism Los Angeles, and Brandy, a member of Refuse Fascism. And we're going to be talking with them about the thousands of protesters in Berkeley this week who confronted and rejected fascist Ann Coulter's Nazi program of ethnic cleansing. Brandy was arrested and charged for shouting that Ann Coulter is a Nazi. That's right. You get arrested for that kind of stuff now. Opening the show up, though, I'm very, very pleased to bring this person to the show. I've been reading his stuff for a while, and his name is Michael Link, and he's a special UN rapporteur on human rights in the occupied territories. And we're going to be talking with him about the recent decision of the Trump-Pence regime to recognize Israel's illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian land. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, definitely, man. Let's jump into this because I got about 1,000 questions for you. So I hope you have a week. All right. The U.S. Secretary of State recently announced that Israeli settlements in what has been Palestinian territory basically doesn't violate international law. That's something that is, you know, I think it kind of shook the earth a little bit when that came out, because that is actually never been anything that has been actually sort of put out as the actual situation of things, but it always has been underlying everything. So let's talk about that a little.
Sure. I think we can begin at the start. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the nations of the world, with the bitter lessons of that war in mind, created the, among other things, the Geneva Conventions in 1949 to regulate what happens in a conflict or a war. Among other things, they put into the Fourth Geneva Convention a strict, absolute prohibition that a country which is occupying the land of another country cannot move its civilian population into that occupied land. And they did that because they saw that was the example of the Germans moving German-speaking people into the conquered lands in Eastern Europe that they conquered in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, and in the Ukraine. And it winds up creating historical conflicts and strife between the indigenous people and the newly arrived people who are there with the protection of the occupying power. So that's been a cornerstone of international law for the last 70 years. And indeed, it was recognized that when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, the Syrian Golan Heights, and the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula in the aftermath of the June 1967 war, immediately there were statements made by the international community that these lands are occupied, the Fourth Geneva Convention applies, and that these initial attempts by Israel in the fall and winter of 1967-68 to set up what were initially in the guise of military encampments, but were actually civilians moving into this occupied territory, was wrong. And in fact, in 1967, the legal advisor to the Israeli Foreign Ministry was asked his opinion, does international law apply to the conquered territories? And what does that say with respect to us moving Israeli civilians into the occupied territory? And he wrote a memo which said this is contrary to the Fourth Geneva Convention, it can't be done, and the international community will probably take a strong stance on looking upon us as wanting to annex these lands. His advice was given, and his advice was ignored. And beginning in 1979, the Security Council began to pass resolutions while Jimmy Carter was president, saying that the settlements were illegal and a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And that was reestablished in December 2016 in the waning days of the Barack Obama administration, when the United States abstained on a resolution at the Security Council, which the other 14 members of the Security Council agreed with, that the settlements, they said the Israeli settlements are a, and I'm quoting, a flagrant violation under international law. And that's been the long-standing wall-to-wall consensus of the international community. It's the decision and position not only of the Security Council, it's been passed in literally probably 100 resolutions coming from the General Assembly. It's the position of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. It's the position of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the European Union, and virtually every country in the world has a position that the Israeli settlements are a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. Only Israel, all by itself, took a position that these settlements were, in fact, not inconsistent with international law. And what we have with the announcement last Monday by your Secretary of State was, in fact, I suppose, a steady position of the U.S. Walking away from the determination that these settlements were illegal. Yes, the United States abstained on the resolution under the Obama administration in December 2016 at the Security Council, but the United States had never taken a strong position in practice opposing these settlements. Occasionally, it would withhold funding, as it did under the George Bush the First administration, to the settlements. There were, but under all of the successive regimes, they said, well, they're an obstacle to peace, but they wouldn't re-proclaim that they were illegal. So this, in fact, is kind of the cumulation of a consistently weakening American position to what Secretary of State Pompei said this past Monday.
Mm-hmm. Now, just going along with around all this, I mean, the fact is that there's a couple things that I found really, really, really compelling in relation to what you've written about this and in relation to this whole question. And one of the things was, is that this has had a terrible impact on Palestinian people. It's not like, you know, that just that there's some people moving in and they're taking over that neighborhood over there and whatever. But this actually has some terrible impact on the Palestinian people and on their existence as a people, because you described this as sort of what you call it, the last nail in the coffin of the two-state solution, which itself was something that was like struggled over for a long time about whether or not that was actually the solution for the Palestinian people. But what does it actually mean on the ground now that this is happening?
Sure. The international community, again, has recognized for a long time, and you see this reflected in the resolutions at the Security Council and the resolutions at the General Assembly, and statements made by a number of countries, including most European countries, that the settlements are not only illegal and a flagrant violation of international law, but they actually harm our principal source of the human rights violations committed on the Palestinians. One, it winds up confiscating their land, both for the settlements themselves, but also for the roads and security boundaries of the settlements. It's estimated the settlements and the lands that they wind up occupying takes up about 42% of the West Bank. The settlements are based in what is called Area C, and this was the West Bank was supposed to be temporarily divided up into areas A, B, and C in the aftermath of the 1993 Oslo Agreement. So in Area C is where the bulk of the Israeli settlements are, and those actually make up 60% of the West Bank. This is the area which the Prime Minister, almost all of his cabinet ministers, and certainly even among many sitting members of the Knesset in opposition, say, we want to annex. And when they annex, it will mean that there'll be no chance for any kind of viable Palestinian state. The Palestinians will be left with a little statelet of disconnected land through maybe anywhere from 20 to 40% of the West Bank. And that's what I think Israel is willing to recognize as a Palestinian statelet. They don't mind if the Palestinians call it a homeland, a state, or an empire, as long as the bulk of the land is actually formally annexed to Israel with all of these settlements, and it retains security control over whatever else is given to the Palestinians. Keep in mind that there are around 240 illegal Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and that houses about 650,000 Israeli settlers. So there are another 20 or so Israeli settlements in the annexed Golan Heights, which belongs in the world's view to Syria, with about 20,000 settlers there. These settlements, you don't build civilian settlements in occupied territory unless you're meaning to proclaim sovereignty over that land. And since 1945, it's been very clear, crystal clear in international law, that an occupying power has no sovereign right over a single inch of the land that they're occupying. So when you think of where we've had major occupations since the Second World War, the United States occupied Japan for about 10 years after 1945, and then it left, and Japan resumed its sovereignty. The United States and several other countries occupied Western Germany for roughly 10 years after 1945, and then it handed back sovereignty to the German people. Even in Iraq, in the aftermath of the 2003 war, the American-led coalition occupied Iraq for roughly 10 years before handing sovereignty back to the Iraqi people. All of those were in compliance with our modern laws on occupation and humanitarian law. To occupy a country for 50 years and to move almost two-thirds of a million people into that territory tells me you're not serious but wanting to negotiate to end the occupation and return the land back to the indigenous people. You're there to annex that land and to proclaim it as being a sovereign part of your own country. And as I said, this has been deemed to be illegal under international law, yet while the international community proclaims international law to govern this, it's taken very few meaningful steps to draw red lines for Israel and say, you've got to end the occupation, you've got to return all of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem to the Palestinian people, and you have to recognize their right to sovereignty and self-determination. This has not happened.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Link, Special UN Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And we're talking about the recent decision of the Trump regime to recognize Israel's illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian land. Now, tell me this. You know, one of the things, and you come up to this as in what you were just speaking about, you know, this question of the settlements, it's they have long been, actually, the attack on the settlements have really long been a major source of legitimacy for Israeli erasure of the Palestinian people. And that has been one thing that's been, I mean, I remember years and years and years ago when I first started doing radio, talking about this and, you know, having discussions and debates with people, including Palestinians, about what was actually going on. And it was always the undercurrent there, and sometimes spoken out loud, was that that this is a major source for Israeli erasure of Palestinian people. And I think that's something that a lot of people just don't even consider these days.
Yes. Look, the heart of the occupation, this 50-year-old occupation, which is the longest belligerent occupation in the modern world, the settlements are the engine of the occupation. If there were no settlements, if there were no Israeli citizens living in occupied land, there'd be no meaningful basis for continuing the occupation, and it'd be a fairly straightforward process for Israel to be able to recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination on that land and to allow for a Palestinian state. The whole purpose of putting civilian settlers into occupied territory is to ensure that it makes it increasingly impossible, improbable, if not impossible, for that land to be handed back. Think of what happened in 2005 when Israel removed the 19 settlements and roughly 8,000 or 9,000 Israeli settlers in the Gaza Strip. Israel had wound up having a close to a national nervous breakdown in removing those settlers from there. And I think that internal political strife that Israel wound up going through has been a constantly repeated upon by the Israeli right to say, well, we can't go through that again. And that's why the more that the settlements grow and the more settlers there are, the harder, or indeed you can now say probably impossible, it is to find a settlement that will allow Palestinians to have enough contiguous land to have a homeland, to have an independent state, and be able to remove these settlers without there being a strong political opposition within Israel. So there's a huge difference between the 8,000 settlers that were in Gaza and removed in 2005, and thinking to remove either 650,000 settlers or 400,000 settlers or 200,000 settlers. You know, the thought certainly within Israel is that that would wind up provoking some kind of internal civil war. So what happens now is that with America as Israel's principal, I suppose, diplomatic and military patron, most of the major negotiations that have occurred since the beginning of the Oslo process in 1993, is how to allow Israel, in effect, to have its cake but eat it too, of being able to keep most, if not all, of the settlements and allow some kind of mini-Palestinian state, or what some people would call a Palestinian Bantustan, to emerge in what's left in the occupied territories that could be given over to the Palestinians. So what it is among all the other human rights violations, beyond taking Palestinian land, taking Palestinian natural resources, taking Palestinian water, and increasingly constricting the Palestinians and their ability to move around East Jerusalem and the West Bank, this has been a denial of the right to self-determination. And the right to self-determination for any people is probably the most important single human right in our modern international law and legal instruments with respect to this. So when the Israeli leadership says having more settlers means we're making it impossible to have a Palestinian state, I think we should take them at their word.
Mm-hmm. All of what you're talking about, this comes on the heels of a whole series of developments by the U.S. in the world and Israel in U.S. and Israel in relation to Palestine. But this whole idea of it sets loose a whole series of developments that I think you said this, that undermines rules-based international order. And it's sort of heavy because the way this came out, how Pompeo just came out and said, yo, you know what? Not going to happen. This is the way it goes. If you don't like it, get out, you know, or die. It says something about the world order that's being put in place right now in relation to, you know, the oppressed countries in the world, but also, you know, in particular in relation to Palestine, which has always been, I mean, it's true. It's for the longest time, it has been a major fight from the time they were first driven out of Palestine. And then when people started to come back and the rest of this, it's been a constant fight for survival. And it seems this is really something that this question of a whole series of developments that undermine rules-based international order. So nothing can actually resolve this in terms of international law or anything for the Palestinian people. They're sort of on their own on this.
Well, let's hope that they're not on their own, because obviously if Palestine ceases to exist either as an idea or as reality, it says something terrible about our ability to use international law for the basis of ensuring rights and justice and equality, which is what modern international law is meant to do. Just as you would rely upon your domestic American law, such as your Civil Rights Act, to try to ensure that there's a level playing field between an employee, for example, in a factory looking for justice who claims that they're being discriminated against their employer. We all know that a statute like the Civil Rights Act is meant to try to even the playing field between someone with very little power and someone with a lot more power. The same thing is true with respect to international law. Its purpose is the same, to ensure that might is not right, that even the weak, particularly the weak and vulnerable, can rely upon a claim for rights that are recognized and proclaimed in international law to find both a political form and a legal form for being able to assert their rights. Now, this is something that I've been working on lately as Special Rapporteur, the issue of accountability in international law, which we lack in the same way that you would have accountability and your ability to get remedies from your domestic courts. The Palestinians only have a few areas of accountability. One is by going to the International Criminal Court and saying that the settlements are a violation, are a war crime under the 1998 Rome Statute. And that they filed almost 5 years ago, and we still haven't finished with a preliminary investigation. The Palestinians are also looking to have a database of all companies, Israeli and foreign, who either invest in the illegal Israeli settlements or do trade with them. And we've been waiting for 3.5 years now for the Human Rights Council to receive the database from the High Commissioner for Human Rights to be able to release it so that we know which companies are involved in this. These are pretty modest accountability measures, which the international community has not done enough to be able to ensure that the Palestinians have a proper forum in international law. At the end of the day, international law is in the interest of almost all of us to wind up protecting, because it's rooted in the values of equality, of justice, and for allowing the weak and the vulnerable to be able to have the same place at the table as the powerful and mighty.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you were talking about how this has actually played out, and there's this, you know, in relation to Israel and the Palestinians, there's this constant referencing to the importance of the two-state solution by international forces. But there's never, and I think you said this, but there's never taking a stand against what the reality is for the Palestinian people, which is something I think you were beginning to speak to in terms of there is a genocidal aspect to this. It's kind of, you know, even when you look at like the secretive way everything's being done, the roster of businesses that are engaged in activities related to illegal settlements, all the stuff, the blacklist that was supposed to be released in 2017, but somehow has disappeared. You know, it seems like there's really an important element, and people need to recognize this, that around the laws that are lacking enforcement and accountability, as you were talking about, also the constant referencing to the importance of the two-state solution by international forces, but nobody ever taking a stand against what the reality is today for the Palestinian people.
Sure. And what we have is the fact that the international community, particularly in Europe, proclaims over and over again that it's in favor of a two-state solution. But it's done very little to be able to enforce accountability upon Israel to ensure that it preserves the amount of land that the Palestinians would need for this. So while they've paid lip service to wanting to proclaim a two-state solution, you know, in recent years it's become a recipe for international inertia. I think it's more like a fig leaf formula, which countries, and particularly European or North American countries, can proclaim at summits as a substitute for taking any consequential action to bring the occupation to an end. In other words, criticism without consequences is meaningless in this particular situation. What is required, I think, is for civil society to demand that the international community, and particularly Europe, wind up putting law into action, of beginning to impose measures against Israel that would make it realize that a shot is now being fired across its bow, that it would wind up, if you would start doing such things as, I don't know, imposing visas for foreign travel by Israelis, or bringing in a comprehensive import ban on settlement products into the international market, or raising legal liability for Israeli and foreign companies that invest in the settlements or somehow or trade with the settlements, or reviewing the existing trade, cultural, and economic agreements we wind up having with Israel. Israel is a relatively small country which depends a lot on both international trade and international diplomacy to be able to function as a modern society. If those were seen to be threatened, I think you would see a sea change in Israeli popular opinion, as thinking we can continue to have this occupation and continue to be a member in good standing of the world community. If they were forced to choose, I think you would see Israeli public opinion turn to saying we have to bring this occupation to an end if we want to be able to maintain the privileges and benefits we have with being part of the international community.
Well, you know, one thing, and this is going to be the last question, but it's actually thinking about that, I think the actual situation, when you really get down on the ground and you look at the actual situation regarding the settlers on Palestinian territory and what it means. I mean, there's, 600,000 settlers and 200 settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank alone. You know, you think about what this is actually going to mean. And again, it's all being done before the eyes of the world. And what's being done is the literal wiping away of the Palestinian people. And that to me seems to be something that people really have to grasp.
You know, it's as if the thought process or those who are in power in Israel is to tell the Palestinians, find another dream. You are not going to be able to have a dream of having a Palestinian state where you can find freedom and self-determination on the lands where you are traditionally from. If you want to find freedom, you have to move and put yourself into exile and go somewhere else. And this is one of the saddest, I think, of commentaries of where we are with respect to justice and the application of international law. If we're not willing to uphold international law here, and it always seems to me that if you are a true defender of human rights, if you truly believe in the application of justice and equality, then this has to be one of the issues at the top of your own personal agenda and what you expect to see from your own political leadership that deals with international relations. Because while there are certainly more serious and deadly issues with respect to the violation of human rights in the world, and all we have to do is just look what happened in Syria, the fact that we've allowed this injustice to go on not simply for 50 years, but for 70 years and longer, when I think of the exile and the non-right of return that Israel imposes with respect to the 5 million or so Palestinian refugees, this has to be something that the world's conscience has to grapple with and come to a successful resolution. Because in the long run, there are presently almost 14 million Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs living between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. They're not going to go away. They have to find a way of having a shared future together. And the only shared future they can have is one that's going to be based on equality and justice and peace. That's the best way for them to be able to present a whole new model, a positive model to the world, and not the negative example we're seeing now.
All right. Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Looking forward to talking to you again soon, I hope.
Take care.
Okay. Take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Michael Link, Special UN Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and we've been talking about the recent decision of the Trump regime to recognize Israel's illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian land. And it's The Michael Slate Show, and we are back. Basically, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Atlas Winfrey and Brandy, a member of the Refused Fascism, about the thousands of protesters in Berkeley this week who confronted and rejected fascist Ann Coulter's Nazi program. All right, now we're going to be taking a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint.
All right, welcome back. All right, tell me that didn't just lift you out of your seats. This music doesn't just lift you out of your seats, put your head up somewhere on the ceiling. And that's where we need to be. We need to have our head on the ceiling while we're talking about things that are dead serious on the ground, all right? And we need to figure all this out. And this next segment of the show, as I said when we were opening it up, it's going to be concentrating on what's been happening in relation to standing up against the Trump regime and the Trump Pence out now movement, all of these things. And we'll be talking with, in the back end of this, we'll be talking with Andy Z, who's a regular on this show. And we'll be talking with him about some of the bigger things and the questions going on and and what's up for this weekend. You don't want to miss this, okay? But before we get into that, we are going to be talking to, and I'm really pleased to be doing this because I've been hearing about this all week, and I really wanted to make sure we could do this. We're going to be talking with Atlas Winfrey from Refused Fascism Los Angeles and Brandy, a member of Refused Fascism, and we're going to talk with them about the thousands of protesters in Berkeley this week, yeah, who confronted and rejected fascist Ann Coulter's Nazi program of ethnic cleansing, yeah. And Brandy was arrested and charged for shouting out that Ann Coulter is a Nazi. In other words, she was arrested and put in jail for telling the truth, okay? All right, Atlas, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Brandy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Great.
Okay. Let me start off a little bit with Atlas. Let's start off with you, Atlas. Describe the scene in standing up against Ann Coulter. Describe what was going on there.
Yeah, sure. Do you want me to speak specifically about the protest itself?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we weren't sure what to expect. We thought there might be a few dozen people or maybe a couple hundred from what we've seen across the country. No one could have predicted that thousands of students would flood into this protest. And, you know, there was an organization called BAM who was there, who helped organize it and lead it. And we were out there with Out Now. And the students, you know, along with BAM, you know, they formed a picket of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students, you know, marching in a circle, blocking the entrances and chanting things like, you know, Ann Coulter is a Nazi, you know, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA. And as well as, you know, slogans from Refused Fascism like Trump Pence out now. Don't tell me it can't happen here. Don't tell me wait another year. Trump Pence out now. And there was just a lot of diverse faces in the crowd. And this was students who are not how they're being depicted by the media as just, you know, some of the more hardcore, you know, anarchist types. Those people were there and they're very welcome, and they were targeted for wearing masks and all of this, which is something we should oppose. But most of the people there were people who it was their first protest, or maybe they were a part of the demonstrations against Milo or the demonstrations against Ann Coulter when she came to campus, and all these kinds of things, who were forming human chains, who were deciding that today the most important thing was to stop this Nazi rally that was going on inside. And people were nonviolent and disciplined in the face of this. They were talking about the world that they want to see. You know, they oppose the attacks on trans people. They oppose the attacks on immigrants. They understand that Ann Coulter is a fascist and about ethnic cleansing. And Refuse Fascism and BAM, they really help people understand that Coulter is a part of what Trump is doing, not something separate from what Trump is doing. You know, these fascist speakers who are going around on the campus and whipping up a youth movement that is in support of Trump and everything that they're doing and preparing a base, you know, to go up against the impeachment and even threatening civil war. And this was, you know, the largest student demonstration that we've seen, you know, in years. And this was explicitly focused around the question of fascism, even while people still have a basic understanding of what that means and are still not enough understanding what it means that Trump is a fascist and how to respond to that. But this was a real, you know, this was a sledgehammer in the wall of complicity. While too many people are not acting and many people saying protest does nothing, you know, this flies right in the face of it. And people were joyous. There was a fire in their eyes that we have, you know, that we have been looking for some time, and it was badly needed. It's a great strength, and it has to be built on. But those are some first points.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Brandy a question here, because, Brandy, you know, one of the things I heard was that this was brand new to you, and yet you made a very courageous and important action in the face of the attempts by the fascists to plant their flag. What did you do and why?
So, yes, I would say this is one of the first times in my life that I've done something as bold as this. I have been to protests before, never been arrested, so it was all brand new. Simply, I was outside protesting as well with the 1,000 courageous students who were also there, turned out to oppose a fascist speaker on campus. And after maybe an hour or two, I found out it was time to start heading in, and she was about to speak. So I made my way in. I had gotten a ticket to do this from the inside as well, and to disturb and assert my free speech and call Ann Coulter for what she really is. So I went in. We made our way to our seats. It was me and two other people. And I waited for Ann to say something controversial and quite racist, which didn't take too long into her speech. And I was immediately met with misogynistic slurs. I was called a Nazi. I was called a racist, surprisingly, and an astounding USA chant from her audience. I did this because I think Ann Coulter, to say that she was there to preserve the right of free speech and to spread her rhetoric and framing it so that Cal students themselves not wanting her there are liberals who are Nazis themselves and who don't respect the First Amendment. I believe she's just turning the narrative on its head and framing it so that she can allow herself to be here knowingly, putting these students and their well-being and essentially just their lives at stake, knowing that her audience brings violence. And I needed to do this because students across the country, students within California, anywhere, need to see that she, a high-profile fascist operator, Ann Coulter, is traveling to these different universities and they are powerful universities that are well known. Like we've seen it in Syracuse having a sit-in. They need to see students take an action like this so they know that this is not normal what she is doing. She is trying to normalize this idea of ethnic cleansing across students across the country, and someone needs to say something and someone needs to call Ann Coulter for what she really is.
All right, Atlas, let me ask you this. You know, Berkeley, you know, people, you know, look, people my age, other people, a lot of people look at Berkeley because, and today it still has a lot of the same character, but Berkeley has always been an important battle is being fought there around a lot of critical issues that are in the air and need to be fought out. And that's, there's sort of a certain legacy of Berkeley. And it seems like a lot of what's happening here, this constant, you know, repetition of trying to bring in all these fascist forces to make their stand and make their comments and sort of try to sway the popular influences and stuff. The legacy of Berkeley and the attempt to establish a fascist pole there. Let's talk about that a little bit, because it seems like that's something in terms of why so many people are stepping up. One, because, yes, they hate fascism. They want to destroy it. But at the same time, there's a real legacy there, too, that people in the rest of the country really need to pay attention to. There's a legacy that says we will not step back. We will not tolerate this kind of assault on humanity that's going to be centered in Berkeley right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the national picture, you know, Ann Coulter is one of many who are touring the campuses, and they've made a special point out of going to Berkeley. And it isn't just about the way they frame the argument about the free speech movement is really wrong. You know, Berkeley is a campus that is a beacon to the world, an example of the upsurge of the 60s, an example of how students can throw off these different forms of individualism and self-seeking, and I have to be directly affected by oppression before I can speak out. It has a history and a legacy in opposition to this, and that stamp is still stamped on the character of Berkeley. And a lot of the people that go there, they go there because they want to be exposed to different ideas. They want to be exposed to that legacy. They go to Berkeley because they think that the campus there, they're going to learn how they can do something about what's going on in the world. And they want to be in the mix of that. And that stamp is still there today. You know, you walk down the campuses and you see these free speech boards, bulletin boards. And right now they're plastered with posters, you know, of people who are trying to get students to support the upsurge in Hong Kong. You know, and this is also having some effect on the mix, that there's a lot of students there that are actually consciously, you know, bringing out what's going on there, the protests and the demonstrations and the resistance and all of that. And that's also on the terrain there. And people are asking big questions on the campus. People are asking about this free speech argument, you know, and some people are seeing more through it and raising the slogan that hate speech is not free speech and that this should be opposed, even while people are still paralyzed by this question and trying to sort it out. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure to how much I'm speaking to your question directly, but there's a lot, there's a big swirl that's going on there that is really positive, especially if we work more to help bring out the positive features. Mm-hmm. And the students there, they don't know so much about the history of what happened in Puerto Rico, but what's happening right now in Hong Kong is having a big impact, and it's something. It's a reference point for people, and I think that's in the mix with what happened, and it's not the only thing, but I think that these factors helped contribute to what happened there.
Right, exactly.
And these students actually helping to make Berkeley Berkeley again, which, you know, this was like a, you know, mm-hmm. this was an example of that.
Mm-hmm. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we are talking with Atlas and Brandy, and we're talking about what happened in Berkeley when Ann Coulter tried to come up and push her fascist gruel into everybody's head. Now, Brandy, we're running up on our time, but I wanted to ask you this, too, because you did get arrested, and there were things that, you know, why don't you tell people about what happened? You got arrested, and where do things stand now? Where do things stand with you, and what should people be doing around this? How do you see that in relation to actually, you know, what happened to you, and in relation to the need to step up and stand against that, but also in the context of pushing the whole struggle forward?
So I did get arrested quite quickly after I spoke out immediately when I was going to be taken out of the Wheeler Hall. I needed to get my last few points out, which was calling Ann Coulter a Nazi and a fascist and, you know, emphasizing what she really is. Immediately when cops were taking me out, I was met with my two wrists being twisted so hard to the point where I felt like they were going to dislocate it. And at that point, that's when I couldn't keep yelling about Ann anymore. And it was more so getting it out there that they're hurting me, they're hurting me. And this was taken outside, of course, and it happened three other times where they twisted my wrist, even if I said it. And so I was being held for about almost, I guess, maybe an hour and a half in one of the rooms in the hallway. Apparently, cops were accommodating by letting me use the restroom and giving me water to the point where, you know, letting me call my mother on the phone or anyone to let them know where I am or just to have my phone in front of me was too much. Following that, I was taken outside for transport to go to the Berkeley City Police Station, and that's where I was met with another protester from BAM who was also arrested and who was also being brutalized in front of a crowd. And so we went into the bus together, and they had put her seatbelt on, but they hadn't put mine on no matter how many times I asked. And when we did ask, both of us, I was ignored, to no surprise. But I think this arrest in the face of many probably puts a little bit of fear into people, but I think it was necessary to be shown to demonstrate that this country keeps pushing forward this fascist agenda and calling it free speech, but not expecting backlash that, you know, just because it is maybe free speech in their eyes, it is indefinitely hate speech to the rest of the country and to students and, you know, people who aren't white that are being affected by this. And they are silencing criticism. And this is most likely the essential features of what a fascist regime entails. Right now, with these charges that I'm facing, I was out on a $3,000 bond, but that was lucky because my total was actually 60 grand. And so the charges that I'm facing are 3 years time with three counts of assault and one count of disturbance. So it's quite a scary time, but it needed to happen so people can see where this censorship is coming from and whose side the cops are on, truly.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Brandy.
Thank you so much for having
us. Yeah, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. And Atlas, thank you, man.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Sure. Look forward to seeing you and talking to you. All right?
Great.
All right. All right. Listen, folks, this is something that actually we gotta take up in a way that's really important to understand what's going on, what's happening here. And one of the things I wanted to say to people, actually, I wanted to say, too, so people know this, Brandy's a member of Refuse Fascism, and she's a student at Berkeley Community College. And it says something about, you know, what happened to Berkeley says something about the potential and the need these days, what needs to be done and the potential for that happening. All right. Next, we're going to hear an interview with Andy Z. Now, the interview took place before the national meetings of #OutNow, which were held on November 24th. You can find out what happened and the plans that were made at these meetings by going to refusefascism.org. We will also be talking with Andy again, hopefully next week, but very soon at any rate. We are living in dangerous times, sisters and brothers, which, as I said, requires all of us to take a stand. Never forget that. And to talk about a lot of this, I want to bring to the show, often a guest at the show, and although not often enough because I really miss talking with him, his name is Andy Z. Andy, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's good to see you. But look, man, before we get into questions here, you know, this was a very big deal that happened at Berkeley. It potentially could be the turn of a certain tide of people taking up and fighting against these fascists. I mean, just free speech? Give me a break, man. This person is on a stage there she's on the stage, and you know, I don't know if people know the kinds of things that she says. You know, she says things like, without the white settlers, what is known as America would still be an unnamed continent full of migratory tribes chasing the rear end of a buffalo every time their stomachs growled. I mean, this is an outright racist, misogynist, fascist. She is allowed to speak, given protection by the police. Somebody gets up and calls her out for what she is, and she gets manhandled by these pigs, and then she slapped with $60,000. But don't talk to us about free speech. This isn't free speech. This is the progressive administration in the town of Berkeley's police, or the campus police, enforcing the right of a fascist to spew words that are backed up by the regime in power, that is costing people's lives, let alone their mental well-being. And this is spreading all over the country, Michael. It's so infuriating. At Syracuse University, they've barely exposed the tip of the iceberg of these racist fraternities who are just engaging in the most vile accusations and taunts and racist stuff. And the black students have been trying to protest this and basically been dismissed by the administration. And this is not isolated to some peculiar thing at one or another school. This is going on all over the country. We've had people drive hours to come to refuse fascism meetings because in their colleges they feel so taunted by these MAGA fascist thugs. And I'll just say this, you know, because you saw the local news in Berkeley, and they had a young man from the campus Republican saying, well, you know, Ann Coulter, she's a provocateur, and that's good because it sparks debate. Years ago, Bob Avakian, the revolutionary leader, said, conservative my ass, these people are blanking Nazis. And that's what has to be seen. There's a dividing line in this society that goes all the way up to the White House, the Supreme Court, well into the military. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is actually the reality that we face right now. So we should get into that. But I just want to say to Brandy that people all over the country got to have her back, because we need more and more people doing that. And then people have to defend her 3 years for speaking the truth. There's your free speech.
Well, one thing that I have to say right now is that we spent a lot of time talking, and unfortunately, we're running up on our time right now. We have about a little bit under 10 minutes. So I wanted you to actually, okay, we can have you back next week or if you're available, but I wanted to talk about this other bigger questions that I wanted to talk with you about. But I do think we need to talk about what's happening this weekend, because there's been a culmination of a whole campaign, of one level of a whole campaign that's been going on for, you know, months. And that actually, there was a mobilization of people around the country. And there's now a need for people to actually sum up what happened and where to go now and how to get there. What's important in terms of what needs to be done? How do we reach out to, you know, tons of, you know, all kinds of people from all kinds of, you know, perspectives? That's what I want. Yeah, and you're having a meeting this week across the country. There's going to be meetings, right?
That's correct, Michael. We're having meetings this weekend because we have to build on what was accomplished in what was a 5-week launch of a broad-based movement called Out Now that is initiated by Refuse Fascism. The actual thrust of this movement is a single demand: Trump, Pence, out now. We think that all kinds of people should be able to unite with this demand. It actually reflects the necessity that people face today in a fascist regime. And, you know, the special rapporteur you had on at the beginning of the show talked about what Trump has done in relationship to Palestine and the settlements. This is an example of America First. What's going on in the campus, America First, and an entire fascist program. We have to drive it out. So we had this 5-week launch. It was, you know, there's not time left here to go into all of what we accomplished, but we got out there. We modeled something about protesting week after week in cities and towns across the country, approximately 12 to 14 each weekend. About 500 people came out each week. At the same time, we went out to key events, such as when Trump showed up at Madison Square Garden, got on international news. I went on your show, and Young Turks, and hundreds of thousands of people heard us that way. At Berkeley, people went out, rather at UCLA, people went out when Don Jr. went out there, who's the open fascist in the family. I mean, Trump's an open fascist, but his son gets out there with the vilest stuff. And, you know, we mobilized 120 people after that, which was way insufficient, but it was better than what it was better than it not being done. And it also is a start. So we had these protests and we put the demand out in front of society. We got the word out. But what we did not do is do what needs to be done. You know, I think I said we've begun, but we have not won. And there's no point to what we're doing if we don't win. And the winning would involve ultimately hundreds of thousands of people in cities across the country. And then maybe ultimately millions of people, the kind of struggle you see in Chile, Lebanon, Hong Kong, Puerto Rico before that, different conditions, different countries. But still, the basic thing is the masses of people getting out into the streets and continuing to stay there. That will actually change the equation, because nothing else will. You can see now with the Democrats are wrapping up the impeachment without having had the key witnesses there, and let alone that they're not impeaching him on all the fascist agenda and have reinforced some very negative thinking in the masses of people and how they've conducted this, which we could talk about maybe next week. But the point is, we're having these meetings to figure out how do we get the millions of people? How do we start with the first several thousand? And nobody has solved this problem yet in terms of continuing protests. Maybe once in a while there's a one-off protest that gets big backing from a section of the Democrats who want the protest as backing their policies. But really, massive protests outside the confines of protest and politics, usually that hasn't happened yet. We're inviting every organization, every individual, church groups, religious groups, synagogues, mosques, student groups. Come on, we got to get together and talk about this and develop a plan to carry this forward in the next month and then beyond that. And, you know, we have an idea. You know, it's not a secret anymore, but the title of our plan that we're going to discuss is There Is No Santa Claus. And he won't remove Trump and Pence. December disruptions, Trump-Pence out now. So we have a proposal for advancing this movement to say, look, nobody's going to free us from this regime but ourselves. And it's going to mean everybody uniting, putting aside differences, putting aside fear, standing up together to demand that this regime be removed. You know, I don't know if one reason the Democrats didn't call the rest of the witnesses is that clearly Pompeo and Pence themselves are implicated in this particular outrage of the Trump regime in the, you know, eviscerating the role of elections by trying to do a extortion scheme, gangster extortion scheme against the Bidens. So this is what this weekend is. And it really matters if people come out. We got to make these links between what's happening. We can't put our heads, too many ostriches out there, too many people saying, well, it's not affecting me. I can, So good luck to you.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about this morning, you know, this whole thing exactly along those lines, and including the fact that right now, you know, the way that people, and we're not going to be able to get into everything around this now, obviously, but there is some stuff to think about, folks, in terms of even what are we talking about? What are we looking at? Are people looking at, well, and I think there is sort of a mind-deadening thing going on when your people are looking at, well, now we have these hearings going on and this will save us and all these things. And people really have to face up to the fact, to what the reality is here in terms of the establishment of fascism, what that's going to mean, what's happening, and what role people have to play. So let's talk about that next week. I'd really like to get into that with you, but I also want you to say again, now give people you know, we got 1 minute, you can give people real quick why they got to be there.
You got to be there because we have to drive out the Trump-Pence regime, because it's a fascist regime. We have to go after this, and it's only going to be done by masses of people. If you think you can sidestep this by working for a progressive candidate, I'm not telling you what to do about the elections right now. I'll tell you what I think about them. But in terms of the out now movement, you need to be out in the streets now.
All right.
What are you going to do if he doesn't leave office?
And remember, folks, making history is not a spectator sport. You're needed to help drive out a fascist regime. All right. Andy, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Okay. And we'll talk to you next week. And I also want to give a shout out to Scott, who said he's a child of Holocaust survivors, who's listening from the East Coast. And he called to give a shout out to Brandy. That's right, folks. Let's keep developing those connections, that internet connections, all this other stuff going on. So we actually have the beginning of the kind of force that we know is needed to actually get rid of all this horror in the society. All right. Okay, so I want to thank everybody that contributed to the show today. I want to thank Teddy Robinson. I want to thank Henry Carson. I want to thank Jeff, who's back in there somewhere, I think, and all of you for tuning in. And if you and write to me if you want to. It's MikeMSlate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Eve of Destruction from Public Enemy. Talk to you again next week.